Welcome to the Full Tracy Money Audio Commentary. This is Owen Tracy recording at 10:27 a.m. That is Pacific Summer Time. And today is Friday and it's March 16th. So this is the big picture long-term audio and video for the various different asset classes. And I'm recording a little early because my daughter is competing in a fencing tournament this afternoon and I've got to drive down to Long Beach. The upshot is that she may qualify for the national championship, so it's a rather big event for her. Well, when we look at the long-term chart for the total return on bonds, then I think one of the most important things about chart reading is to be able to take a step back and to look at the price action and to simply ask a question. And it is very simple. These are the fundamental questions that we deal with at the chart seminar, and I'm greatly looking forward to going down to Melbourne next month to meet with subscribers. I used to live in Melbourne, and I really look forward to you revisiting my old stomping ground, quite literally stomping ground, because my very first job as a backpacker straight out of college was traipsing all over the neighborhoods of Melbourne, selling Optus door to door. Well, one of the things that we look at the chart seminar is that we look at consistency characteristics and we to look at filter questions. Well, when we look at filter questions, then what are the things that we ask? The first is it trending or ranging? And we always want to look at as much back history as we can find, because by looking at the back history we can tell ourselves a simple thing, whether it is in a big bull or bear market. So that's the first thing. We look at as much history as we can get our hands on, and that's something that very much I think is worthy of consideration. So the first thing is, bonds have been in a massive bull market for 30-odd years, and it's longer than that, in fact. And then we ask another question. Well, has it been trending in a consistent manner? Well, it was trending in a consistent manner until at least 2015. In fact, it only went up. And I think that when you're thinking about a trend, how can you ask for anything more than that when the price only goes up? Every time it went sideways, it broke out. Every time you had a pullback, it was followed by a new high. All you had to do was buy the dips, and you were golden in the bond markets for the last 35 years. How could anyone wish for anything more than that? But the funny thing about people is that we tend to think that the longer something persists, the greater the likelihood is that it will continue to persist. It is a little bit like Wile E. Coyote running off the cliff in those old Roadrunner cartoons. Eventually he'll look down and find that he is so very far above the valley floor. Well, we then ask another question. Is the trend, what were the consistency characteristics of the trend? The consistency characteristics of this trend were really quite simple. That it trended higher in a very aggressive manner. Every time it ranged, the reactions were comparatively shallow. Then it broke upwards, and each one of the ranges was one above another. Every single time for the entire bull market, each successive range is one above another. And that stopped in 2016. We have now got a range that is below the previous range. That's a clear inconsistency. If we have to think about it in any other terms, it speaks to top formation development. At the very minimum, it's a loss of momentum. But there is another important characteristic, and it is this. When we get a breakout from a range, we ask a simple question. Does it change the fundamentals? And the answer is no. It changes the perception of the fundamentals. When you get a breakout from a range, people generally look around and they try to rationalize it and they try to figure out why did the breakout occur. But the more important point is that it does not change the fundamentals themselves, but rather it changes the perceptions of the fundamentals. But the longer that a trend persists for, and the more ranges that are resolved on the upside, and the more consistent the trend, then the greater the likelihood is that the trend itself will change the fundamentals. And it is that changing of the fundamentals of the market that will eventually contribute to the top. And this is equally true of every asset class. And it happens in bonds. It happens because as prices rally, the yield depresses, the incentive to issue debt increases because there is a massive incentive to reduce the cost of capital and to lock in low borrowing costs for as long as possible, and that's exactly what we've seen. And now we're getting to a point where, having seen the supply of bonds accelerate in the period from 2008 onwards, with a lot of them having maturities in the order of 10 years, there's a great deal of additional debt now needs to be refinanced. We are in a rather strange condition because the USA, having been expanding for in a modest manner, albeit in a modest manner, for much of the last few years, is now engaging in stimulus without a recession. And that is going to represent a change. It represents, I think, a response to the kinds of factors that were, well, I think, well, let's just ask it in a question form. What changed in the last few years that initiated this whole new way of doing things that was different from the entire trend that persisted before that? So I think that's an important point. Is one of the reasons that bonds did so very well. Well, one was because of technological innovation, that we had Moore's Law, which delivered increasingly efficient chips. Then we had the evolution of the internet, and that had its own disinflationary impact. Then we have had revolutions in biotechnology and transportation and in energy, and all of these factors have contributed to a disinflationary period. In this period as well, we had the fall of the Berlin Wall. We had the acceptance of the preeminence of a capitalist economic structure, and we had globalization really come into its own. And what that contributed to was further deflationary pressures. It created a market for just about everything globally. It created a fungible source of new labor, that things could be produced in one place, sold in another, and the cost of transporting bits and pieces from one country to another to and then to create this incredible global supply chain, that all became a lot easier with the fall of the Berlin Wall, and created this disinflationary environment where the outlook for emerging markets took off. And that continues to remain the case. And the adoption of capitalist economic structures has created a massive middle class in the emerging markets, where, and then we have Africa, where there is an additional 2 billion people will be born and grow up in the next 30 years. And that represents the primary area for population growth. But all of these factors contributed to the outperformance of the bond market. But the other point, of course, is that globalization and technological innovation have resulted in the hollowing out of the middle classes, and it has affected large swathes of the population. Because one of the points that you get with constitutional democracy is that it's messy and it has plenty of room for disagreement. But generally speaking, what you get is a general tendency towards politicians buying votes and appealing to vested interests from well-connected voter groups, such as unions or government employees, or when they do not apply specifically to those groups and to larger groups of poorer people, then they're called populist. But the reality is that when we look at the way that democratic institutions work, it is that they tend to buy votes from somebody. And that is exactly what you're getting in the US right now, that the change that has occurred has been towards a populist environment to give to those large numbers of disaffected voters, whether they are people who are no longer employable because the industry that they depended on has migrated somewhere else, or that the industry they relied on is completely outdated, or that they have found that they've been working for their entire lives and now that their pension reserves are completely inadequate for their needs. Well, all of those people ask a simple question, and it is very simply, what about me? And that question has, the answer to that question has manifested itself in the form of stimulus in the USA, which is going to contribute to additional supply. And additional supply after a 35-year bull market, that is about the clearest characteristic for a top that one can possibly begin to countenance. That's exactly what we expect to happen. Well, in the UK, that question about what about me has manifested itself in a wish to, I think, retake independence from the EU, which is considered to have stifled growth over the course of the last few decades. So that also represents a change. Well, then within Europe itself, you have Germany, which has been the singular and perhaps the greatest beneficiary of the EU. And part of the reason that it was able to benefit so fantastically was because of the reforms that it instituted after the fall of the Berlin Wall to ease reunification. It's also where you see the fewest signs of voter disquiet against the EU, and yet the AfD, which is a far-right party, is now, according to a recent poll, the second largest party in the country. So even in Germany, which has been the greatest beneficiary of the European project, then we see disquiet. Then in Italy, two populist parties have halved the country. One, representing the Mezzogiorno, has captured just about all the votes in that area. And then you have the Lega Nordea, which for the longest time campaigned to split the country in twain, has captured a lot of the votes on the northern side of the country. Both are trying to answer that question, what about me, by saying, we're going to give you more money. And that's the most common of all of these answers. We'll give you more money. Then, when you look at what's going on in Spain, and you see, for example, that pensioners are very unhappy with the rises that they're getting to their pensions when inflation is picking up, well, then the next government, if it isn't the current government, it will be the next government, and what they will deliver is more money. And of course, one will have to ask the question is, where is that money going to come from? Well, that money is going to come from bonds. They are going to be issuing lots of them. And what this represents is a classic supply increase following a massive bull market. So we know then we have I think a clear example of the fact that this long-term trend changed the fundamentals of the market. It contributed to it rose because of a disinflationary outcome, but the disinflation that it was able to achieve was at the hands, or I guess at the expense, in fact, of the middle class. And now you're getting a revolt by the middle class against the status quo. It's being manifested in a large number of different ways, and they're variously being referred to as populist, xenophobic, anti-immigration. But that the moniker, it matters less than the trend, and the trend is towards a revolt against the status quo. So that is not good news for bonds. A revolt against the status quo, when you're the asset class that has represented the status quo most vociferously for the better part of 40 years, that is not good news. When we look at what is going on in the 10-year treasury in the USA, then what we are presented with is a base formation, and 3% represents the upper side of that base. A base is a range, and a range is an explosion waiting to happen. So when it eventually breaks out, and it could yet consolidate, it has already been consolidating for 6 weeks, but it could consolidate for a while longer. But when it eventually does break out, it's likely to do so in a dynamic manner. And a lot of people are thinking that 3% is a psychological Rubicon, but it could quite easily get to 3.5% or even 4% in very short order once it eventually breaks out. That is the nature of breakouts. The breakout will go faster and farther than anyone is willing to countenance when the price or the yield is still within the range. So I think that this is something that is going to be a very important topic for the rest of this year. When we think about the long-term trend, this is a major change in the market. Everything is priced off of the 10-year. So, and that is particularly the case for the kinds of investments that represent a bond proxy. So, for example, consumer staples has been trending higher in a consistent manner for much of the last decade. And it was particularly consistent until approximately the middle of 2015, when it had a much larger pullback. If one had been following a midpoint danger line stop, it would have been stopped out at that point, at least on an intra-week basis. Then it moved up and moved into a much more choppy environment where there is a marked loss of momentum. Then we have this large downside key reversal at the peak in February of this year. And now the price is back testing its lows. It is trading below the trend mean, and the mean is turning lower. It is right in the region of the low that we saw in December of last year. But if it breaks down, well, then it will have broken the progression of higher reaction lows. It will at least be a reaction similar to what we saw in 2015. But it's coming from a much higher level. It's also coming after a massive reaction against the prevailing trend. And we can't then suggest that it's a surprise that it is pulling back. Now, of course, one of the biggest constituents of this index is Walmart. And Walmart has pulled back violently over the course of the last few weeks, and it showed just initial signs of finding support in the region of the trend mean in here this week. Well, if we're going to look at Walmart, we should look at the consumer discretionary sector as well. Consumer discretionary has been doing better, and but it also pulled back rather sharply in February, and it is now at a point where we can consider that it is ranging with a mild upward bias. Well, we had an upside, excuse me, a downside key reversal on Tuesday, and we have not seen any follow-through. But part of the reason that the consumer discretionary is doing so well is because of Amazon. And Amazon has been eating everything, but it has accelerated now to $1,600. And we're seeing at least the first signs of a pause and consolidation. But this is certainly not a dynamic move, and it's nothing even remotely similar to what we saw back at the beginning of February. And we know that Amazon is prone to occasional bouts of volatility, and that it can pull back to the region of the moving average in a violent manner. But it would really need to be sustaining a move below the trend mean to really question the integrity of this advance overall. Amazon is the one company in the world that is taking over just about every sector that it lays its eyes on. And eventually that will lead to some form of antitrust movement against the company. I think that that is the greatest risk outstanding to a company like Amazon. But there's absolutely no sign of that just yet. But it isn't so much that we have a problem with Amazon, but rather that we have a problem with the kinds of companies that are still within this sector. So, for example, if we look at the constituents of the consumer discretionary sector, these were among the companies that did best in the bull market so far. And when you look at, for example, Walt Disney, which is going sideways, or Ralph Lauren, which had been trending lower until quite recently, then it's probably worth thinking about some of these kinds of companies, that these have been the victims of Amazon's success. Ralph Lauren collapsed from 180 to 60, and now, following massive rationalization, it appears to be on a recovery trajectory. Disney has not had the rationalization. It's going sideways. But it's going sideways with a downward bias. Or, in fact, to be more accurate, it's a triangular bias, that we have the progression of lower rally highs, and we also have a progression of higher reaction lows. Well, when it breaks, it's going to break in a dynamic manner. And these triangular patterns almost inevitably give way to very dynamic moves, either up or down. And the $100 area represents a key psychological level for a share like Disney. When we think about what the outlook is, then, what we have seen evidence of has been a rotation over the course of the last few weeks, that we're getting a rotation to a certain extent out of the industrials and back into the mega cap technology shares. If we look at the FAANG index, which also includes companies like Twitter and Baidu and Alibaba, then it remains on an upward trajectory. And as long as that is trending higher, then that is going to represent a tailwind for the wider market, because it represents a significant weighting of the wider market. Technology alone represents 25% of the S&P 500 today. So, therefore, the fate of the market is in large part tied to the fate of the technology sector. When we think about what the risks are from the bond market, then what it is in all likelihood going to represent is a move up in yields due to social change, rather than the vociferous return of inflation, although there's certainly evidence that inflationary pressures are rising. But it is, to my mind at least, the more likely scenario is that the kind of move that we're going to get is going to be socially driven because of this change that we've had and this revolt against the status quo. What it also represents is a change in how companies are likely to be viewed from the perspective of their prospects. The kinds of companies that do better in an environment when you have a rising yield environment are either those that can raise their dividend faster than the rate of inflation or the interest rate, or those that can grow considerably faster. Well, the technology sector certainly fits into that category. If we simply take the Nasdaq 100 as a barometer, then it continues to represent relative strength, and it continues to hold this move above 7,000, despite the fact that there is a short-term overbought condition relative to the trend mean. Then, when we look at go back and think about the consumer staples sector, well, they have bond-like characteristics. And if we look at the sector and then perhaps look at its yield, well, the consumer sector tends to find support at a yield of around 3.5%. And 3.5% represents something of a magic number for the consumer staples sector. So it's currently at about 3%, and what that suggests is that the we could have yield expansion up to about 3.5% before people start to go back and think about the sector representing value. When we think about the long term, we continue to have this growing demand for just about everything. The rise of the global consumer continues to represent a very powerful bullish characteristic. So, against that background, what we can begin to think about is that if we do get a bigger pullback in the consumer staples, it's likely to represent a very attractive buying opportunity because these are the kinds of companies that are leveraged to the growth of the global consumer. And there isn't much that is that could potentially derail that rise of the global consumer because of the adoption of capitalist economic policies. But the big question then is about governance, because governance is the central argument about investing in any market. And when you have a liberal democracy with and most particularly a constitutional democracy, where there is the likelihood that if things go too awry, then there will be a change of government and that the system is eventually self-correcting. That contributes to the sustainability of the system, that there is the potential for it to be self-correcting. The fragility of dictatorships is that they don't have the self-correcting mechanism. So what that means then is that they may look very strong, but that they tend to be quite fragile. If in any country there is, I think, respect for minority shareholder interests, if there's an independent judiciary which can uphold those minority shareholder interests, and if you have a free press which can highlight injustice that that is being conducted either by the corporate sector or by the government, then you have at least the conditions for governance to improve, or you have the conditions that the courts can uphold issues that arise as a result of deteriorating governance. So, for example, in countries like India, you do have all three of those characteristics. And that does not mean that India will not pull back on occasion. And it was down, back down to the region of the moving average this week. In fact, one point that we can pretty much be sure of in India is that it is capable of having big pullbacks, and that almost universally those big pullbacks have been buying opportunities. So it is now pulling back towards the region of 10,000 on the Nifty, and if the trend in the short term is going to remain consistent, then it will need to find support in this area. But if it fails to find support around 10,000, well, then we'd have to conclude that we are back into a more corrective phase for the Indian market that, if history is any guide, could take a couple of years to unwind, but that it will set us up for the next big investment opportunity in the market that remains on a secular upward trajectory. India is the kind of country that is among those best positioned to benefit from the rise of the global consumer, improving governance, and the application of technologies, that they have taken biometric data from everyone in the country. They have set up online bank accounts for every family in the country, and 4G internet connectivity is almost universally available. That even though you have upwards of 300 or 400 million people who are illiterate, then they can still access the internet via their phones because they can log in with their thumbprint and they can search for items via voice recognition. So these are incredibly important themes, and what it suggests is that India is being primed for a digital revolution. China has already had a digital revolution. It really got its genesis after 2008, where China realized that it needed to have a domestic demand-oriented sector to act as a support for the economy because it was too reliant on the international or international business, and it delivered a digital revolution. So what that has contributed to is a significant number of companies that have listed in the USA, and they're now being encouraged back home. Well, they're being encouraged back home, not least because the government is moving towards progressively more control. China does not have an independent judiciary or anything close to it. It no longer has a self-correcting mechanism because Xi Jinping has just voted him, and ensured that he changed the constitution so that he's going to be in power for life. Then we have the fact that there is no such thing as a free press. And in fact, China is attempting to influence the press just about everywhere else, too. So there is no response for, or I think, respect for minority shareholder interests. So when we look at the potential for advances, companies like Alibaba and Baidu and Tencent, they are all now being encouraged to relist in on the domestic Chinese market. So what that will do is create a market for Chinese depository receipts that does not currently exist. And that will then open up the ranks of the Chinese mainland to invest in these national championship, and what that could potentially do is result in them moving up another leg. And if that does occur, then that will probably represent a trend ending because of the acceleration that that would represent. So that is a potential short-term outcome that could happen for a number of these big Chinese technology companies. But the reality is that when we look at China in terms of governance, that the risks are rising, that there is no respect for minority shareholder interests, and that respect is in fact trending down rather than up. So China deserves an additional risk premium, and I think that that is perhaps the most important point when we think about it in those terms. Technological innovation is, I think, appreciating at an increasingly rapid pace, and not, I think, in no other sector is it appreciating so rapidly than in biotechnology. That the evolution of CRISPR gene editing technology, that you have genetic sequencing from Illumina, that is going to create less than $100. Genetic sequencing. And these are enabling technologies in much the same way that the drive towards building out 5G is both a theme in and of itself, but it's also an enabling technology. The massive amount of money that is being poured into batteries is an enabling technology. When you get evolution in the pace of innovation in healthcare or in energy in particular, then what they tend to do is not only to represent bull markets in their own right, but that they have seeding effects, that because they are so powerful, that what they contribute to is innovation in a whole range of additional sectors. And that's exactly what we're happening. The pace of technological innovation is occurring outside the financial cycle. So what that then represents is a very powerful bull market. And it is driven by, and that is part of the reason why these large technology shares are so very dominant. That it isn't simply that you have this massive innovation in companies like Google and Amazon and Facebook, but also that the semiconductor index has been trending higher in an aggressive manner for 2 years already, and it was at a new all-time high again in here this week. Actually, I'm not quite sure it is an all-time high, but certainly, yes, it is a new all-time high. when we look at it on this very long-term chart, we can see that the price is probably better supported now than it was back in 1999, but there is no denying that it has gone up quickly and that we are still in a more of a corrective phase, even though we're at new all-time highs, that there is the potential for some pause of consolidation. And my hypothesis has been that this trend is not yet over, that we have had a major change in the supply of money, and that with tax cuts and with a move towards more fiscal stimulus, that what we have in fact had was that everyone knows that central banks have been flooding the market with liquidity for the last decade, and the total of central bank balance sheets is currently around 2.7 trillion. Well, eventually that is not going to continue to be rising because the Federal Reserve is already taking some money out of the system. The ECB will have tapered its largesse at some point over the course of well, probably up until September. And subsequent to that, they will start reducing the size of their balance sheet. In fact, it's the ECB is the only central bank that has reduced its balance sheet at any point in the last decade. The Bank of Japan is still engaged in quantitative easing, though not as aggressively as it was previously, and China is neutral. So eventually that is going to contribute to the pace of this advance leveling off. But to the extent that the US is reducing the size of its balance sheet, it's increasing its deficits. So that is also another change that we've had a change from synchronized global monetary expansion, and we're potentially moving towards synchronized global fiscal expansion. And again, that will eventually contribute to not just socially driven inflation, but outright inflation. Well, until we get a major uptick in inflationary pressures, then the potential is that the technology sector could move into a bubble. And bubbles generally don't happen until you get a policy mistake. And the reality is that adopting pro-cyclical policies in an already well-developed market environment is a policy mistake, and it will likely contribute to a bubble environment. I think that we have to at least now consider that that is the potential outcome, that we know what the long-term themes are, that the rise of the global consumer, that the technological innovation will persist, and that we are getting a revolution in energy, that these are very important long-term considerations, but that the bigger picture is in the bond markets right now, and that it has the potential to upset, or at least to delay the other secular advances. So we could have I think we could have a bubble develop in, and then we have a I think the unwinding of that bubble before we get a lot of these big trends starting to persist again. So when we think about where are we in terms of this cycle, the medium-term bull market that began in 2008 is maturing and could potentially climax in a mania, and that mania is likely to be led by the technology sector. Then the mania will eventually be derailed by rising interest rates and by government bond yields moving up and changing the valuations of these markets because of the yield differentials, and the growth rates relative to bond yields are going to become less favorable if bond yields are higher. Eventually, that will contribute to a repricing, and then we will get a rotation. And then we will start to see probably the consumer staples starting to recover once more. So I think we are at a period of time where we can expect things to change, that we can anticipate that when we look at these longer term trends, that we have had some big changes already, and that there are very clear secular, long-term trends that are unlikely to be derailed by what happens in the bond markets or what happens in terms of the mania that we're likely to have. And that we will get buying opportunities at some point over the next few years, but probably not until after we've had a mania. And I think it is reasonable to assume that Amazon is now in a mania phase. It is at a point where valuations are already stretched. It is massively overextended relative to the trend mean. So far, it has not pulled back in a violent manner, and that there is the potential that it will do better from here. But we have to also then start to pay particular attention to the kinds of things that lead up towards recessions, because rising unemployment would certainly be one of those. Then, for example, if the yield curve does move below zero, well, then that would be a lead indicator for recessions. We've seen a very minor beginning to rising government bond, or excuse me, high yield bond spreads, but so far they have been inert for a year, and they remain relatively inert. And they, in fact, have to be trending higher for a while before they represent a headwind for stock markets. So if we start to string all of those things together, there is no indication yet that there is a recession going to happen this year. And if that is indeed the case, then what we have on the stock market is a range, but probably not much more than that. And the range could persist for a while longer, for the simple fact that we had a pullback that was larger than anything we've seen in years, and that usually we get a period of ranging following that that can last for anything up to from 6 months up to a year and a half. But subsequent to that, then we generally get a breakout. And the reality is that technology is already leading on the upside. So the range might be more in the order of 6 months rather than 18 months. If that is indeed the case, then the potential for a bubble to form will have been strengthened considerably. That is the point at which, and I think we're already at the point where we need to pay particular attention to the consistency of trends. And that is perhaps the most important thing to take away right now. We have the rise of the global consumer, and that is billions of people striving for a better standard of living, and they're largely succeeding. We have enabling technologies that are driving the pace of technological innovation. Just this week, you had MIT setting up a new company to commercialize fusion energy, an arc a fusion reactor. And that is an iteration of something that we've noticed for much of the last few years, is that 10 years ago they were saying that it would take 25 years to develop a fusion reactor, and 50 years ago they said it would take 25 years. But in the last few years they have said it's more like 10 years. Some people have said it's even more like 5 years. MIT is saying it's probably going to take them about 5 years to develop the supercapacitors to create the magnetic fields that will be able to contain the plasma in a fusion reaction, and probably another 5 years to build the reactor. And that means that they are thinking about having a functional fusion reactor by 2028. Well, that would represent an incredible change to the global economy. It would be the kind of thing that would create the genesis of a secular bull market in future as the technology gets rolled out. Solving for the energy question and innovation in energy is the kind of thing that can drive secular bull markets for decades. So these are the kinds of evolution and that we're getting in the technology sector that will help to drive secular bull markets in future. But the shorter to medium term outlook is for there a real prospect for there to be a problem in the bond market that could have knock-on effects for everything else, which means that when we see that trends are losing consistency, most particularly if we see that trends are have pulled back in a violent manner and then range below the peak and then break down, well, then we have to recognize that for what it is, and it is top formation completion. At that point, it really is worth taking money off the table, because the potential is that there will be much more attractive buying opportunities later. If we see clear accelerations that are beyond the capacity of investors to comprehend, and we have real-time evidence of that at the end of last year, where Bitcoin prices went from 10,000 in November to 20,000 in December. This is about as clear an example of acceleration as one might be able to ever get. And I think that this is something that we have to at least pay some due diligence to, that we have had markets that have accelerated, that have had bubble characteristics, that have had mania characteristics, and they have been comparatively small. But the reality is that what they are representative of is this desire by the disaffected classes to go outside the system, to try something different, and to rebel against the status quo. And these are all symptoms of a wider problem. And we are not anywhere close to resolving that problem, because the answer to the question, what about me? And when people say, well, here's some money, that's a bribe, that's not a solution. And we are nowhere near to a solution. So until we get to that point, we can anticipate that political polarization will increase, because political polarization is required to get to the point where you get the reform. That is the self-correcting mechanism on which democracy relies. Then that is perhaps its most unique strength. It's not a weakness. Then I think that is perhaps the point that a lot of people miss, that this ability to self-correct is democracy's strength. Whereas you just do not have that in authoritarian regimes. So we know that there is the potential here for a self-correcting mechanism, and self-correcting mechanisms represent a change to the fundamentals of the market, and most particularly the bond market. So when I think about the long term, I think that there are incredible opportunities in terms of the of optimism towards humanity's potential for innovation. But the risks are that are certainly residing in the bond markets. And I think with that, I will leave you for this week, and I'll wish all the best to all of you.